Welcome to Soundbites, true stories told by local Mainers and nationally recognized storytellers. The themes are always changing and the hosts are from all over the nation, but when you hear the name Soundbites, you're in for a unique storytelling experience. Soundbites is made possible by the generous contributions of Allagash Brewing, Frontier, The Press Hotel, and by the listeners of Maine Public Radio. This story was told at Frontier in Brunswick, where the event's dedicated theme was seen and unseen. Here's today's host, one of Soundbite's very own producers who lives here in Portland, Donna Galuzzo.
You gotta elevate the next teller. I'm gonna welcome to stage, and I want her to float up here on some beautiful, loving applause. Welcome, Katie Brown.
Thank you. It really makes you want to do some jive talking when you get an applause like that, bringing you up on the stage. That works wonders. That's really nice. I have never told a story to a live audience before. I'm used to telling my stories in the backseat of a car, just trying to make road trips pass. The story I'm going to tell you tonight is about the first time I discovered a dead body. So for another night, I'll tell you the second time. So this happened when I was 5 years old, and I was an army brat, and our family had just moved to upstate New York, Ithaca actually, which in the early 70s was a really groovy time. I think the students of Cornell University had just finished their big major sit-in that shut down the campus for a lot of reasons. There was a sit-in, there was the Vietnam War, there was terrible discrimination still rampant in our country then. We thought it was all over by now, but we all know it's not. And I was moving to this town with a Army captain father. My mother had left the Navy only because she was pregnant with me, and women had to leave the Navy back then. The neighborhood we moved into was across town from the Cornell campus. My father was sent there actually to be with our ROTC program at Cornell. That's why we were in Ithaca as an Army family. And the neighborhood we moved into was all ranch-style housing. It was a neighborhood with a lot of police officers, FBI agents. Somehow they all found each other over in this neighborhood. Occasionally there'd be a split level, but this is what the neighborhood looked like. And it was a great neighborhood because there were tons of us kids just running rampant everywhere. It was my first year there. I was in kindergarten, and my best friend, Andy, lived just up the street from me. And all of our parents were career parents, but both of our moms worked part-time because we both had little siblings. And it was our mom's job to come home and take care of us eventually during the day, but often if my mom was working late, I would go home to Andy's house with him after school. In kindergarten, we were dismissed before lunch, so we'd go home for lunch and for the rest of the day. And Andy had a babysitter always at his house, an older woman who was in charge of looking after him and his sister, his baby sister Laura, until his mom came home. So one day, when I went over to Andy's house, we were at one point playing in his room alone together, and he said he wanted to show me something, and so he unzipped his pants, and he pulled his little guy out, and he sort of stretched out on the floor and stared up at the ceiling and said, "So when I rub it, and I rub it, and I rub it, and I rub it," and he proceeded to rub it, and I just watched patiently and waited, very curious, and just chilling out, doing our thing. And I looked up suddenly, realizing that I'd been feeling a presence in the room, and there was Mrs. Crowdy, the babysitter, standing in the doorway. And I was so startled and realized that she'd been standing there for quite a while, not having said anything. And I thought, I tried to ESP to Andy. Andy, stop. And he didn't. He just kept, "And you rub it, and you rub it, and you rub it." And so I just kind of turned away and almost did like the thing. And his little kitten was under his bed. And I started just like playing with the little kitten under the bed, just willing this moment to pass. suddenly she blurted out, "What are you doing?" And she said it in such a disgusted, nasty way, I wouldn't even want to imitate it because I think I'd have to go crawl off the stage and hide. And the poor kid jumped 50 feet and, you know, covered himself up so fast. And I just remember the two of us just like curling up in balls of shame. And I don't remember what she said, but eventually we were let out of the room and she eventually fed us lunch and time went on. So I don't know if it was weeks later or months later, because it's so hard to tell the sense of time when you're that young, but yet again, another time I was home. I went home with Andy after school till one of our moms got home, and there was baby Laura playing on the floor, and Mrs. Crowdy was sitting on the couch, sort of zoned out to the television, and we could smell lunch. Some sort of lunch was warming up on the stove, and I imagine it was probably SpaghettiOs from a can, you know, our favorite. And she didn't say hi to us, so we just sort of entertained ourselves waiting for lunch. And I started to sense that something was amiss, and I took kind of a closer look and realized something's wrong. And so my instinct was to get Andy away. And I don't know if it was because I was an Army brat, you know, of two military parents, and we'd actually gone through family emergencies together, and I somehow had an instinct for how to handle the situation, and I suggested that Andy and I go in his bedroom and just take a rest. And so we padded down the hall, went into his room, and we curled up on his little bed to rest, and I think that's something that we used to do a lot, so it was familiar. And but after a few minutes, he got up and he said that he was going to go sleep next to Mrs. Crowdy. And I didn't stop him. I didn't say anything. And I just laid there for a while and I just kind of like stared at the wall, just hoping that one of our moms would come back soon. And after a little while, he came back into the bedroom crying a little bit. And he said, "I think something's wrong with Mrs. Crowdy." So I got up and I went into the living room. Baby Laura was still playing on the floor. Didn't have to worry about her. She was completely distracted. I took a real close look at Mrs. Crowdy, and she was in the same position as she'd been in when we got there. Her eyes were half open. They weren't watching the TV. They were dead. And I remember her mouth was just frozen into the shape of a diamond, and it just stayed in that shape. It was an unnatural shape, and that was the sort of final clue for me to realize that she was dead. And that's when I further took action. Something came over me as a little five-year-old. I can't even imagine what that looks like. And I said, "Andy, why don't you go in your room and just stay in there?" And I knew to call zero for the operator. That was something we were all trained in. I think Sesame Street taught us that. Our parents always taught us that. And so I dialed zero, and I got the operator. I knew the address where I was because that was something we were always, you know, latchkey kids. You know everybody's address. You're always having to recite them back to adults. So I knew exactly the address of where I was. And I just told her, "I think the babysitter is dead." And there was nothing more I could say, you know. And I'm certain she asked me questions. "Well, why do you think the babysitter is dead?" And I so wish I could remember what I said or had a recording of that. But anyway, I do remember when the first wave of emergency personnel came, and then eventually more, and then the coroner came at one point, and somehow they managed to get a hold of one of our moms, and I don't remember if they got there at the same time, but I do remember seeing Andy's mom, and I remember seeing my mom, and walking back home with my mom, and she was really apologetic to me. She said, "Katie, I'm so sorry that you had to go through that and that you found her like that." And I said, it's okay. You know, it's all right, Mom. It didn't feel like a big deal to me in a lot of ways. And ultimately, what I felt was great relief that now Mrs. Crowdy no longer had that memory of Andy rubbing it, and that we could go back to our lives without deep shame and embarrassment and get up to all our old ridiculous shenanigans again, which we did. Our next big shenanigan was to stand in his backyard for days on end and yell, "Beauty spells butt." And what finally ended it was his mom coming outside one day and saying, "Andy, Katie, B-U-T, but spells, it means, and she somehow described it intellectually, what you mean is B-U-T-T, which means but. And I remember we just looked at her and stared at her and never did that again. But it was really, you know, I have to say that if Mrs. Crowdy hadn't been such a grump with us, I would have mourned her passing a lot more, but indeed it was a relief. We got on with our lives. So that's my first story of discovering a dead body, and so I'll come back next year and tell you the second one. Thanks.
A little bit more about Katie. Katie Brown is the co-founding director of the Locker Project. They're a nonprofit based in Portland that manages food pantries and fresh produce distributions in schools for children who are food insecure. She is also a professional mascot. She was born in Houston and raised in upstate New York. She attended Sarah Lawrence College and moved to Portland 29 years ago. Thank you, Katie Brown. That was fantastic.
Join us now for a conversation before the tell backstage. Our storyteller talked with the host to give us some interesting facts about them.
What is your connection to Maine?
My connection to Maine is a whim and the flip of a coin. I was trying to figure out where I wanted to live after college and was literally flipping a coin one night in my schoolhouse and trying to decide if I was going to stay in New York or move to Texas or move to LA or move to Japan. And a housemate stumbled in and asked what I was doing. And she said, well, why don't you come to Maine with me for the summer? Her father was the co-founder and owner of the Maine Times. And I'd never been to Maine before. And I said, sure, I'll come for the summer and then I'll figure out where I want to live. And that was nearly 30 years ago.
Wow, that's awesome. What got you into storytelling?
I'm not sure. I was born doing it. I think I gabbed stories from the day I could talk. And when I was about 5 years old, I started writing ghost stories. And they all started, once upon a time, Katie and Tracy were in the woods and they saw a ghost. And it ended the end. And in my mind, everything that I was seeing was on the paper, and so everybody who was reading my stories were seeing the same things too. And so it was through training, you know, feedback from teachers, well, what else happened that I learned how to tell stories properly.
Katie, what's your process for preparing to tell your story?
Mainly just clearing my head so that I have few distractions, so that when I'm telling the story, it flows honestly and freely. If I overthink it, I run into trouble because I'll start getting tripped up in details. It's different from writing, obviously, because you can go back and edit and edit. But if I start overthinking a story, I'll get so full of details in my head, all jumbled up at once, that it won't come out smoothly.
Can you tell us about a part of your story, maybe some behind-the-scenes detail that didn't make it into the piece tonight?
The piece that doesn't get included in tonight's story is about the second time I discovered a dead body.
Soundbites is made possible by the generous contributions of Allagash Brewing, Frontier, The Press Hotel, and by the listeners of Maine Public Radio. Special thanks also to Toad & Co. More information about Soundbites, including how to attend a live storytelling event, is online at soundbitesme.org. And of course, you can always hear more stories at mainpublic.org.